welcome to episode 440 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode, I follow up on last week's episode, which was 11 overrated factors for triathlon performance. Today, we get into underrated factors for triathlon performance instead. Most of these are completely new and different from what we discussed last week, but there are a couple of items that are basically the reverse of what was already discussed. But that's just a couple of them, not too many. So there will be lots of new content and new ideas for you to listen to today. I would like to get some feedback on both of these episodes and on any episode, really. So whenever you have any feedback on the podcast, feel free to always email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And that's Michael with a K. And also remember that you can send in questions that I'll answer on Q&A episodes that I do regularly, either as solo episodes or with an invited co-host, like we did a couple of episodes back in episode 438 with Lockie Kieran, another scientific triathlon coach. But for today, before we get into the main content, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. They are effective because they contain just the things we know work in the right amounts and nothing else. They are practical because they're based on increments of 30 grams of carbs and 500 milligrams of sodium, making it really easy to hit your numbers and follow your plan. And by the way, you can use the free planner on their website to create your fueling and hydration plan. And they're tasty in a neutral, mildly sweet way. So for me personally, it has been far easier to consume higher amounts of carbohydrates, especially over multiple hours since I started using since Precision Fuel Hydration started producing their gels and energy products in the first place, because when they started out, they were only doing the electrolyte products. They also produce great content on their blog and newsletter. It's very well researched and also very practical and pragmatic, so I highly recommend giving it a look. And also try their Fuel Hydration Planner. As a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order of products by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. For a lot of athletes, the limitation to swim training is that it can be very time-consuming to swim when you consider everything that goes into a swim, with commuting to the pool, all of the faff that you may have to get through at the pool before actually getting into the water, and so on. This means that it might only be realistic to swim once or twice per week, but with the Senate, you can complement that pool swimming with quick and efficient home-based workouts that challenge the swim-specific muscles, so you can increase that all-important frequency of training and give yourself a chance to keep improving your swimming even when your pool time is limited. You can try the Senate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatecenter.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the main content for today, 15 underrated factors for triathlon performance. Before we get into the list, just a couple of quick general points to mention. Firstly, as the list is quite long, and as a few of the points on the list, as I mentioned, are basically the reverse of items that I already talked about last week on the overrated factors episode, I tried to keep things a little bit shorter and more concise for some of the items, or most of the items on this list, so that the episode doesn't get too long. We'll see how I actually manage and how long it ends up being. I have no problem doing very long interviews, but it is quite exhausting sometimes to do long solo episodes. So that's why. It's not that I don't think that the listener base will have the willingness and the attention span to listen to a longer episode. It's more for my sake than anything. Secondly, just like last week, when I say that these things are underrated, it doesn't mean that people don't understand the importance of these factors necessarily. It can mean that there is a smaller subgroup in the larger triathlon community where maybe these aspects are underrated, in my personal opinion, of course. Or it can also mean that even though everybody more or less understands that something is very important, it's not actually implemented and prioritized to the degree that it should be. So it remains something that we think I should be doing that about rather than actually doing it. And finally, the final general point here to mention, the items on this list are in no particular order. With all of that being said, let's get into item number one, which is the big picture. This is in contrast to what I said last week about workout details being overrated. With the big picture, I mean that it is underrated to start from the 10,000 foot view and focus mostly on that and getting that right, rather than immediately zooming in and focusing on the details, but missing those important higher level layers. So just as an example, focusing on the big picture can look like starting from analyzing what overall training volume that you can do time-wise and what discipline-specific training volume as well. Also, what you should do in terms of training volume to create a sufficient stimulus for adaptation, but without doing too much to risk injury and overtraining. Those are all very much big picture questions. Other examples would be how and where to implement your harder sessions and where to implement your rest days or restful days among this training volume. And in contrast to these types of questions, starting by planning out the details of your interval sessions, how long intervals, how long recoveries, what exact intensity, that's focusing in on the smaller details that don't matter as much. And then doing that first might actually limit your options in regard to the other more important factors. And not to mention that it just takes away time and energy that you might have to focus on the more important questions. And to be clear, normally when I talk about the big picture, I'm not talking about just the training program, but I would include all of the big rocks underpinning performance there. However, in this episode, because we will cover many of these other big rocks, or at least the ones that I would consider underrated, we are, for the purposes of this episode, just referring to the big picture in terms of the training program with this item number one on the list. But to sum up, I think the big picture is a very underrated factor behind performance, not so much in terms of pure awareness and acceptance of this importance, but just in terms of actually acting this way and prioritizing and allocating time and energy accordingly. Item number two is consistency. I'm sure that every single listener knows that consistency is important. So in that sense, this is not at all an underrated factor. But again, this comes back to the same thing I just talked about with the big picture, that knowing that something is important and actually acting and behaving accordingly are different things. One of my favorite quotes is by author James Clear, who said, "You don't rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems." And in my experience, both with coaching and also in one of consultations, this specifically is one of the key things that set apart age group athletes, especially that continue seeing good progress over a long time, that in their bad times, let's say, in terms of training, the rough times when things are busy, unexpected things happen that take time and energy out of them, and life gets in the way, their systems and habits still allow them to maintain some level of consistency. The worst weeks are, of course, never going to be as good as the best weeks of training, not even for professionals who do this for a living. But I think the level of training that you manage to maintain in the more difficult and challenging times is a very underrated factor for triathlon performance. Basically, it's quite easy to focus on training well and being consistent when everything is smooth and things are going well. But when life gets in the way, that's when your consistency gets tested for real. And where those who manage to do okay, not good, not great, not perfect, but just okay, they have a huge competitive advantage because so many just end up doing poorly in this period and completely lose any semblance of consistency. You can think about it like a grand tour, actually. If you have a flat stage in the first week of the race, then the whole peloton will be able to finish at pretty much the exact same time. But then when you have a mountaintop finish in the final week of the grand tour, you might still have a decent-sized group until a few kilometers from the finish of that final climb on the day. But then in just a few kilometers at the very end, the best riders can put minutes into everybody else. Because things are so hard at this point, you're under so much challenge and so much stress. And this is when and where things are hard, that's when the best riders can make the biggest difference. And it's the same with consistency, really, in all of us triathletes, whether it's age group or professional triathletes. So to sum up, consistency is not that hard when nothing is impeding us. It's when life gets in the way, that's when it gets really hard. And this is where not forgetting about consistency and just trying to have some systems and habits in place to manage to do just okay rather than poorly can make a massive difference. And this, I think, is hugely underrated. Remembering to be consistent, not just when it's easy, but when it's actually hard to be consistent. And it will happen to everybody, but not everybody deals with it equally well. So keep this in mind and try to make sure the next time that life gets in the way for you, that you can be that grand tour cyclist that puts minutes into everybody else on the final climb in the final week of the tour. Item number 3 is stress. This one, I think, is more of an underrated factor in the traditional sense that many athletes go through their training without even the awareness that it might not be a problem with their training itself that is impeding progress, but a problem with too much total stress. I think it is really hard to see this objectively about one's own life. And I'm speaking from my personal experience here, knowing that I'm pretty bad at it myself. The reason being that a lot of times the stress we're taking on is quote-unquote good stress. It's often people that really enjoy things like their jobs and are focusing on advancing their careers or building their business. Or it can be good family stress with wanting to be really involved with everything that the kids are doing. Or it can be things like coaching a kid's team in some sport or coaching in the local tri club or volunteering in some ways. All of these things that are extremely positive, but it's just a combination of taking on a lot alongside triathlon training and, well, work and family, of course. It just means that the total stress becomes too much to have room for the body to adapt. And I would say that the type of person that tends to underestimate the impact of stress is also usually the type of person that does take on a lot. And while it is, in a way, stressful, this type of person tends to see it as all as good stress. It's not a negative in the same way that it might be for others. And this personality trait of taking on a lot means that they also generally want to train a lot and be ambitious as a triathlete. And very often what I find is that actually reducing the training volume and the training load leads to better results, simply because in this way we are reducing the total stress by reducing training stress, and that can increase adaptation to training. This point about stress also goes a little bit hand in hand with the previous point about consistency, specifically in the harder and more stressful periods of the year or the stressful periods of life. You might be able to combine all of the things you take on for large portions of the year, but then in the busiest 1 to 2 months of the year, it just becomes too much. And due to this overloading stress, the training consistency drops below that level of okay that we are looking to achieve as a minimum. So I think that for most of us, and I would definitely include myself here, to some extent, we underestimate how big a difference for adaptation stress makes and how important it is to think about this, even if you're not somebody that takes on 100 different projects and responsibilities at the same time. You just have your normal job, normal family commitments, and triathlon to focus on. But a key learning here is, I would say, to take the number of hours that you think that you have to train in the week, reduce it by 10 to 15%. So if you think you have 10 hours, reducing by 10%, meaning that you shoot for 9 hours as your weekly goal instead of using all of the available hours. Because the reduced stress of having a little bit more blank space will often make up for that slightly lower training volume by better adaptation. It's a fine balance though, because of course, to some extent, you just have to put in the work. But it's usually worth at least experimenting with, because some athletes might be very stress tolerant in that they don't perceive themselves to be stressed at all. And they might be the ones that can respond really, really well to this kind of small reduction in training volume, because the body still experiences that stress. It's just not perceived in the same way by certain people. So yeah, point number 3 that is underestimated is stress. And this is something that I would encourage everybody to think about in their own lives. Item number 4 on this list is sleep. And sleep has been getting a lot less underrated in the last 5 years or so, I'd say. But I still run into cases of athletes who are not just not getting anywhere near enough sleep, but are also completely unaware of how important sleep is. I know that with the increased spotlight that sleep has been getting, this may seem strange to a lot of listeners, but as with anything, I think it just really takes time for things to become so mainstream that everybody knows it and knows something and realizes something. Sleep is getting there for sure. The awareness is quite widespread, but it's not complete yet. So that's why I would include it on this list. Even among the large group of athletes that know about sleep, I feel like if I have a consultation with an athlete or I'm starting to work with a new athlete, it's common for these athletes to always be eager to talk about their training and find things to improve with their training. But what I want to talk about before getting into any of that is, how is their sleep? How is their stress level? How is their nutrition? So in that sense, from my personal point of view, I think that sleep is underrated, because it is often seen as something that, well, it's not, it is what it is, and let's just get on and talk about training. But I think that we can't talk about training without talking about adaptation, and we can't talk about adaptation without talking about sleep. So for this reason, for me, sleep is one of those things that is still quite underrated, because it's not something that gets the scrutiny that it should be getting compared to the training, for example, that seems to get all the scrutiny when that's only part of one part of the puzzle. Item number 5 is coaching and expert help. And first of all, of course, I am biased here because I am a coach, but I think that coaching and other expert help is actually hugely underrated. And let's clarify first what I mean when I say other expert help. In this context, I would include various services like sports psychology, bike fitting, aero testing, swim technique, registered dietitians, and there are probably others that I could think of that can be really, really helpful and valuable for triathletes, depending on what the specific needs of the individual are. But just to explain a bit more clearly what I mean with expert help. And I'm not saying that every triathlete needs all or any of these, really, but a lot of triathletes are driven and basically want to become the best that they can be. And for this type of athlete, I think there is nothing better than getting completely individualized guidance and advice, and especially with a rapid feedback loop to accelerate the development process and to take your development further than it could have come otherwise. This individual guidance is what I think is underestimated. And I think the main reason is that we have access to so much information. And of course, a lot of the information we have access to is actually complete garbage. I don't think that you, dear listener, are consuming that information, because you're listening to this podcast, so you clearly have good taste and can distinguish good information from garbage. And there is lots of great information out there as well. And you can go pretty far with the good information that is out there. But there is a distinct difference between pretty far and getting the best out of yourself. And there is also a distinct difference in the rate of development when using good but more general information versus getting individual guidance. So that would be the difference between, for example, consuming this podcast versus having a coach. It just happens, development happens a lot quicker when you're actually getting that individual guidance. And if we look at professional triathlon as an example, the trend in professional triathlon is that the best athletes have grown up doing triathlon from a pretty young age in most cases. So they have had coaches for a long time and continue to have coaches to this day. They're also building amazing teams around them of other experts, including people like, well, their managers, but also people like aero testing experts, nutritionists, psychologists, and so on. And at the same time, today's triathletes tend to know a lot about the sport and about training. Many professional triathletes are coaches themselves, and they, in a lot of cases, actually have things like sports science degrees. But despite this, they have these teams around them. So the ones that try to do it themselves generally don't do as well as the ones that build a great team. And if we compare this current trend with each generation of professional triathletes that has come before, I think the sport is just so much more professional now, and the athletes know that just like in with a pro cycling team, it takes a team effort to get the absolute best out of the athlete, and it's a real human team. It's not a team of chatbots and algorithms. So of course, a regular age group athlete can't compare themselves to a professional athlete, and they can't be expected to invest in a team in the same way. But this is where, and I recognize again that I am biased here, but I think that a coach will often know something about everything. So you can get a little bit of help with your nutrition, with psychology, with bike fit, alongside the actual expertise area of the coach, which is the training. But that coach can also give some input to these other areas where you might not need a complete expert, and then the coach can recognize that in this particular area, you maybe need a true expert, let's say, for example, a registered dietitian, if you have some problem with nutrition, and then the coach can recommend this to you and refer you to a good registered dietitian. One more thing on this topic on coaching and expert help that I think is underrated is seeking out this guidance sooner rather than later. So let's say that you're in the sport for 15 years in total, but you only have a coach for 3 of those years. Then for most people, I think that you're probably not going to have a coach the first year of triathlon. It probably doesn't make so much sense because you need to just find your place in the sport a bit, figure out what you want to do with it, if it's even something that you want to pursue. But let's say that you have a coach years 2, 3, and 4 of your triathlon career. Then the learnings that you'll get from those 3 years, you can and should take with you and use for the rest of your career. This means that years 5 to 15 of your career will be a lot better than years 2 to 12 in that second scenario when you only get a coach for the final years, years 13, 14, and 15 of your career. And the same can be said for other services. So for example, if you work with a registered dietitian early on and they help you figure out how to fuel well, that can potentially save you from a bunch of problems throughout your career, like avoiding stress fractures and relative energy deficiency in sport. Or in contrast, maybe they can help you lose a bit of extra weight safely early on if you have extra weight to lose. And then you can go through the rest of your career without that, which could also potentially reduce your injury risk and improve performance. So I always say that getting help from coaches and other experts in this sense is like compound interest and investing. If you start as soon as possible, then the returns that you will get by the end are that much greater, because even small positive changes compound over long periods of time, and that can make a massive difference down the line. Item number 6 is pacing your workouts well. This one I think that a lot of people are not thinking about, but I do think that how you pace your workouts can make a big difference over time. Basically, for the most part, you want to pace your workouts evenly or with a slight negative split so that you get slightly faster towards the end. This applies for both endurance work and for harder sessions. In some really hard sessions, let's say VO2 max intervals and even harder potentially, then you could argue that it's not necessarily optimal to pace the session this way. And I can see that argument, although I also think that there are arguments for still pacing these types of sessions, VO2 max intervals, for example, even despite the high intensity. I guess, though, I would say that at this high intensity, if we're doing a session like 5 times 4 minutes at something that we might call a VO2 max intensity, then I'm not as fussed about pacing as it is. It becomes more of athlete preference in my mind. But up to, let's say, threshold intervals, I am quite firmly of the belief that you should be pacing your workouts evenly or with a slight negative split. And the main reason I think that it is advantageous to pace your workouts this way is that by pacing evenly or with a slight negative split, it allows you to either do the same workout but with, or at the same output but with lower perceived exertion, or to work slightly harder, so higher power or faster pace, for the same perceived exertion. Just like in a racing scenario, we know that in races like marathons, 10Ks, etc., the way to set the fastest possible time is with an even split or slight negative split. I think in running, this has been shown from distances from the 1500 meters and all the distances upwards, of course. The 800 is the longest distance where you generally don't benefit from a negative split. So if we turn this on its head, what it means is that it's not that you get magic benefits from evenly pacing or negative splitting your workouts, but I think that if you overpace your workouts, so that is, you tend to start too hard in workouts like threshold intervals, or for that matter, in general endurance workouts, you basically end up consistently underperforming, even if it's not too much, but maybe you're 5 to 10 watts lower on average in your threshold intervals than you would be with an even or positive split. And that's nothing over just for one workout. But if this happens in many different sessions across swim, bike, and run over multiple years, then it ends up adding up to quite a lot. And of course, lots of athletes, especially more experienced athletes are naturally or through training already very good at pacing and do this habitually without even needing to think about it. But I would issue a challenge here to you to go through your training log from the last 2 weeks, check every session that you did, and including the easy endurance work, and try to form a picture of whether you overpace in certain workouts, whether you do positive splits or negative splits or even splits. And if you do positive splits, so you start harder and finish slower, then try to focus on changing your pacing patterns. And especially over a longer time period, this can make a much bigger difference than you might expect, in my opinion. Item number 7 is heart rate, using heart rate and using a good heart rate monitor. This one is pretty straightforward. We've talked many times on this podcast about how using a combination of RPE, heart rate, and power or pace allows for much better intensity control in the training that you're doing, and also much better analysis after the training. If you don't use heart rate, you lose quite a lot of potential for deductive reasoning and analysis. So for example, let's say you do a harder workout on the bike, but it's a session that you've done before. Your power is the same as you've done last week, but your RPE was a lot higher. It just feels a lot harder this week. If you have measured heart rate, then you have much more information to draw conclusions about what might be going on and why it felt so much harder. For example, if your heart rate is unusually high, then maybe the reason is that you were dehydrated or the environmental conditions were more challenging, so maybe more hot and humid. However, if heart rate was unusually low, then you can probably rule out those two options because that would almost always result in higher heart rate. But it's rather more likely that you are fatigued, perhaps from training load or perhaps from other external stressors. But it would definitely point more towards some kind of fatigue when your heart rate is unusually low, but RPE is high. So in the first case, you could then make adjustments in terms of hydrating better and rehydrating more. And also workout timing, choosing to do the session earlier in the morning. Whereas in the second case, your adjustments might be to scale down your training a bit for the next few days or even take some rest days. So completely different outcomes. But this is all dependent on you having access to heart rate. Well, it's not all dependent because you can also do, of course, some reasoning and guesswork without having the data. But the data certainly helps, and I don't see any good reason to not use heart rate. So despite how important heart rate data is for making these sorts of informed decisions, a lot of athletes don't use heart rate or only use heart rate that they get from a wrist-based sensor, which to me is as good as useless, not because it's always wrong, but because it's sometimes wrong, so it's not reliable enough to draw conclusions from. It may be right, but it may also be wrong, but that means that you can't really rely on it. So in contrast to how many athletes go out and do sessions or do any training without heart rate, very few athletes would go out and do at least a hard run, let's say a track workout or an interval bike session, without measuring pace on the GPS watch for running or power for the hard bike session. And the same really should go for heart rate. Measuring heart rate with a good heart rate monitor, not a wrist-based sensor, that's clearly underrated in my opinion, and I would say that this is something that everybody should do if you want to really get the most out of your training. Item number 8 is watts per CDA. So this item is a metric, and it is in contrast to one of the items that was on the overrated list from last week. Last week I talked about how watts per kilogram is an overrated metric in a triathlon context due to the types of courses that we have. That is, unless you're climbing mountains, watts per kilogram doesn't really matter for performance, but watts per CDA does. And watts per CDA is probably underrated because it's very hard to measure. But just because something is hard to measure doesn't mean that it's unimportant. Just like something that is easy to measure is not necessarily important, as we see with watts per kilogram. But basically, if we take a standard long course triathlon bike course where bike handling has minimal impact, let's say a course like Kona, then there will be an almost perfect correlation between speed and watts per CDA. So if you are faster than your friend in Kona, you almost certainly had a better watts per CDA unless your friend crashed or something. It's really important, though, to understand that watts per CDA is not a static metric. It's not something that you can say that my watts per CDA is XYZ. It will vary based on the course and the day. Courses that have a few steep rollers where you're out of the error bars will naturally mean that your average CDA is higher than a course where you can stay in the error bars the entire time. So just like power and CDA varies based on the course and the day, and it's not a static number, watts per CDA is also not a static number. It's something that is specific to each race that you do. Anyway, it's actually not important to measure this number or know this number in most cases, but what matters is understanding the implications. And the implications are very simple. And this is that assuming that your bike handling on a given course is decent, it's not costing you time, then the two factors that underpin your bike split and your bike performance are power, and that is absolute power in watts and not relative power in watts per kilogram. And factor number two is your aerodynamics or your CDA. So basically, working on both of those is really important for getting you your fastest possible bike split, and working on other things is probably not super relevant. But again, we did make the assumption there that your bike handling on the course is decent, and we'll get to this a little bit later in this episode. Item number nine is bike adjustability. So last week I talked about bike frames as one of the overrated factors for triathlon performance, and I think actually that's probably one of the easiest thing to put on the list of overrated factors. It's by far the least cost-effective way that I am aware of to getting a faster bike split, if you can even get a faster bike split, which in many cases it's not guaranteed. However, one thing that is underrated and can have a positive impact on bike performance is bike adjustability. This is partially frame-related, of course, but it is related to the frame plus all of the components and how things are integrated and so on. The most important components here to consider are those of your front end and how easily you can do things like adjusting your stack and reach, changing armrest position, and so on. Because the thing is that if you can do these sorts of adjustments easily, it will make any bike fitting that you do, any aero testing process that you do, that much easier and more effective, which in turn means that you can potentially improve comfort, power, and aerodynamics much more. If things are more easily adjustable, it also lowers the barrier to entry for you to do some follow-up adjustments from a bike fit or aero testing perspective on your own that you might not be able to do otherwise. And in this way, you can have a more continuous process of improving these factors. So bike adjustability, I think, is very underrated for these reasons, because it can have huge impacts on comfort, power, and aerodynamics indirectly. Item number 10 is riding a course well. So although we just talked about bike performance on most triathlon courses in non-draft events being mostly based on watts per CDA, there are a few more things to riding fast than just pure watts per CDA. And I've used the umbrella term riding the bike course well here to describe that. And I think this is something that is quite underrated by not all athletes, but some athletes, and especially athletes that haven't necessarily spent a lot of time riding their bike outdoors. Riding well here encompasses bike handling on more technical courses. So for example, in the World Championships in Nice, then you can gain or lose a lot of time depending on your descending skills. But it also encompasses knowing how to maintain momentum, especially over rolling courses, by applying the right amount of power at the right moments. If you're riding a rolling course at a completely steady power, for example, you will ride significantly slower than if you ride with a variable power that maximizes maintaining momentum and speed and regaining speed effectively over those rollers. So I think riding well, it is an underrated skill. And in some cases, athletes seem to completely forget about anything other than a steady target power number and try to hold that steady target power number, which isn't the best way to ride as fast as possible. Basically, I think what you want to do here is that you always want to research your target race course very well and try to simulate it in training and practice the various aspects of riding such a course fast, which in certain cases will be carrying momentum on rolling terrain. In other cases, it might be descending well on an alpine descent. Or it might even be doing 180-degree turns and sprinting out of them for a draft-legal city circuit in draft-legal triathlon. So it's not about focusing on holding a certain power completely steady for the duration of the bike leg, but it's about understanding the demands of the bike course that you're training for and making sure that all of the riding the course well elements that exist on that course, that you master them, or at least that you don't give up too much time on them. Item number 11 is race experience. I think this is underrated, and especially race experience from doing different kinds of races. Even if your main focus is on one specific distance, there is a lot that can be learned and translated across different distances, especially from shorter distances to longer. Also racing single sport events like doing road runs, open water swims, cycling time trials and road races, and so on. They are all very valuable options and all add to your experience that you can use and benefit from in your target triathlon races. That's not to say that everybody underestimates race experience. There are some athletes that probably race a bit too much, racing every weekend or every other weekend, and then struggle to fit in the training needed to make improvements. But I do think that this is more rare, at least among triathletes, than not racing enough for optimal development. As a general trend, I haven't seen not racing enough, racing too little, be a problem with athletes focusing on sprint and Olympic distance races. And also much less commonly with athletes focusing on the half distance. But where I typically have seen this to be a problem is athletes that mainly focus on full distance triathlons, Ironman distance. And because some athletes really focus on this distance, might only race twice per year, which might be two full distance Ironmans, or it might be one full distance and one half distance race. And this is just quite a small amount for building that racing brain, and also for getting exposed to different challenges and different scenarios. Usually, a lack of racing experience doesn't necessarily lead to any big consequences. Basically, it's just that you might have been able to race a few minutes faster with more experience for various reasons, but it's not a big deal. But the worst case scenario can be quite a big deal. Basically, it can be that you DNF in a race that you potentially paid closer to $1,000 to enter if it's an Ironman. And this is when, if something a bit unexpected happens that you haven't really experienced in a race before, it might cause you to DNF. A typical example would be some kind of adverse weather conditions, either cold, hot, or heavy rain. For example, let's take a particularly cold day. Athletes with lots of racing experience have probably already encountered this challenge in other races, even if they are low-key, shorter distance events. So that when this happens on the big day, they have that prior experience to lean on, and they have a better idea of how to handle the situation. Of course, an athlete can handle those situations without having had prior experience. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but it just means that you're slightly more likely to be able to handle the situation well when you have actually encountered it before. So this is where race experience can really be helpful. Race experience is also how you refine your ability to pace yourself well, and it's the ultimate test of your nutrition hydration strategy. And it's where you learn to go really, really deep and managing the psychological and emotional ups and downs of the day. And you can, of course, and you do, of course, train all of these things in your regular training, but it's not quite the same. You can never fully simulate race day in training. So every race that you do provides that ultimate challenge and ultimate training experience for your next big race in a way, in all of these aspects. I don't want to exaggerate this one because I think that a lot of athletes do race a good amount and have plenty of race experience, but it's just for a smaller subgroup of athletes. I hope that maybe this can be a good trigger to go and sign up for a few more races. And the longer the race distance you focus on, if you focus on Ironman especially, then the more you should think about signing up for shorter races, as obviously the taper for and recovery from an Ironman is completely different than that of a sprint distance. So you don't necessarily want to disrupt your training too much by all the races, but you want to do races that you can just taper a little bit for a couple of days and recover from in a day or two as well. So that's another challenge from this episode to athletes, especially if you feel that you might fall into this group of lacking a bit of race experience. Item number 12 on our list is nutrition and hydration. We are getting towards the end of the list, so bear with me for these last few items. And with nutrition and hydration, I think that over the last few years, there has been a real shift in how we are all doing race nutrition and hydration. Everybody seems to be generally well-prepared, have a plan for their race, and most have even practiced that plan in training, which is awesome. So I think that what is underrated is not the race nutrition hydration aspect, but rather the nutrition hydration in training outside of the race-specific training. So for example, when you're in the middle of winter and you're 5 months away from your next race and you do a hard indoor bike session, how do you fuel? How do you hydrate in that session? This, again, obviously doesn't go for everybody, but as I said before, when starting to work with a new athlete or consulting with an athlete, before really talking about training itself, I would normally always first talk about sleep, stress, and nutrition hydration in training, in racing, and in day-to-day life. And there are certainly cases where the day-to-day life nutrition hydration is suboptimal, but in my experience, that is much less common than the in-training nutrition hydration. This is an area where you could potentially have pretty huge gains to make for very little effort, if you are really not optimizing your in-training fueling and hydration. It doesn't take much effort. It is basically just forming a pretty simple habit, and it does not have to be expensive. You can basically just mix sugar in water, maybe add some salt to do it on the cheap, because the important thing really is to get in those carbohydrates during training. That's the main thing. And after that, you can worry about if the whatever you're having, if it sits well in your gut, but you can basically get away with sugar and water. I talked before about how on the professional side of the sport, the increased expert help that athletes are getting is one factor in how much faster the sport is today than even just a few years ago. Obviously, the equipment being faster is a huge one as well. But I think that the change that we've seen in fueling and hydration in not just racing, but also in day-to-day training is another big contributor. Basically, everybody is now on the kind of more higher carb side of things and making sure that they fuel well and can do more training, can train harder that way. So if you're not yet fully dialed in with your training fueling, then there's no time like the present. And there are no excuses really, because it's actually one of the simplest things of all the things that we talked about today that you can implement right away. So just time to get on with it. And if it's something that you have maybe been underappreciating, then just give it a try, see how it works. I think it will work wonders. Item number 13 is finding the right running shoes. So everybody probably understands what a game changer super shoes have been for run performances. They make a huge difference, not just in the speeds, but also in recovery. So backing up from harder running sessions, for example. But what I think is underrated is not the use of good shoes, but finding the right shoe within the subgroup of super shoes, basically. I feel like there is a perception that you can buy basically any super shoe. Usually people would like to stay with a brand that they have already been using, and it doesn't really matter what shoe it is. You buy the super shoe of that brand, but it can matter a huge deal. It wouldn't be uncommon for one person to try two pairs of super shoes in the lab, and because their running economy is so different in the two pairs, then one pair might be 10 seconds per kilometer, which is 16 seconds per mile slower than the other. I have experienced this personally, comparing super shoes in the lab. So this is where we close the loop on that little teaser I had in last week's episode when I said that there's one type of lab testing that I would consider underrated rather than overrated, and that is testing and comparing shoes to find the fastest pair for you. So it is a running economy test, but it is a very specific kind of running economy test where you're comparing running economy for different shoes. And now, for this to be something that you can do, of course, you would need to have at least two pairs of super shoes that you want to compare, which is an investment in itself. And the lab testing itself is not free either. But when you consider how much money you're now saving on bike frames after hearing last week's episode, in comparison, super shoes are practically free. So I would say that, yeah, if you're somebody who isn't scared of spending some money on your hobby, then this is where you can actually get a huge return on that money by comparing and finding the right pairs of super shoes, because basically it can save you 5 to 10 minutes over a marathon if you are currently in a pair of super shoes that are fairly slow for you, and then you find a pair that is very fast, or the fastest pairs of super shoes that you can find. There are very few other things that can save you as much time in just kind of one go, one testing procedure. I'm not going to go into the actual testing protocol now, but I will link to two episodes where I have talked about it. So the first one is an interview with Dr. Dustin Joubert in episode 322, where we talked about super shoes in general and the testing itself. If you do not have a lab available, I do recommend going to a lab if you really want to get the most accurate information for this kind of testing. However, I have also discussed a treadmill-based protocol in episode 399, a Q&A episode, where you can use just speed and heart rate. It is not perfect, but if executed well, it should allow you to find which pair of shoe is faster between 2 to 3 different models, unless the shoes are very close in running economy, in which case it doesn't matter so much anyway, then you can basically choose whichever you like the most. So those are two episodes that I recommend going and having a listen to learn more about the actual protocols. But this is an underrated aspect of, an underrated factor for triathlon performance, finding the right super shoe for you, because the shoes that you are in right now, if you haven't really thought about it, then maybe they are not the fastest for you. A final thing that I will say is that anecdotally, the distribution of different super shoes on people's feet in races seems to be much broader than the distribution of test results that I have seen. Granted, I haven't seen that many, and it is purely anecdotal. But I don't think I've ever seen any test result where the fastest tested shoe wasn't either a Nike or an Asics shoe. So if you can buy 2 to 3 pairs to try, I would choose 2 to 3 pairs of those two brands and start there. There are definitely others that you could add to that if you wanted to test more. But this is absolutely where I would start based on everything that I've seen. But to wrap up here, I think this is a huge one and worth pursuing if you are ambitious about being the fastest triathlete you can be. Then it's not enough to just be in a pair of super shoes. It needs to be the pair of super shoes for you to really be the fastest you. Item number 14 is heat preparation. From what I've seen, this seems to be gradually creeping into the consciousness of athletes, but still mostly for races that are pretty much guaranteed to always be hot. Think races like Kona, of course, Singapore, and similar. But I think that heat prep is still a bit underestimated for other races, racing outside of those super hot locations and destinations. So a lot of races in North and South America, in Europe and in Australia, where the climates are such that in theory it might not be so hot. You can't guarantee it being hot on race day, but then there is also a fairly significant chance that the race ends up being quite hot or very hot indeed. So in Europe right now, this is what I can peek to the most closely. There are definitely a lot of races that are very hot, even though they are in climates that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be that hot. To be honest, looking back, I can say that even as a coach, I have been underestimating this the heat preparation all the way up to and including this year. It's easy enough to do. Think about races in, for example, Germany. The first thing that springs to mind is not that the race will be very hot, but this has happened in the last few years. Just to give one example of one country, most of Central Europe is the same, and many places in the US as well. You don't think of them as hot, but race day then can end up being super hot nevertheless. So in this episode, we won't cover how to do heat prep, but I think it is time to realize that for most races to take place in summer, no matter where you are, there is a significant risk that race day will be hot, and it's best to prepare as if it will be hot, because if you don't and it is hot, then you are in for a tough day. Even if you do end up with a nice and cool day, then that heat prep was not a waste of time and energy, because from what I've seen, most people seem to respond quite well to heat prep as a general fitness boosting protocol, which could be due to an increase in hemoglobin, which we talked about in other episodes in the past. So that heat prep that you did will stand you in good stead regardless of the weather on race day. So I think that this is something that, even though it is getting more appreciated, and it's getting more and more common to do some kind of heat prep. But there's still some ways to go. It's no longer a tool just for places like Kona or just for pro athletes. This is something that age group athletes need to be doing because there are so many hot days in so many hot places that we need to adapt to this. And heat cannot be an excuse not to perform well because we know so much about how to prepare for it now. And we should be expecting summer races to be hot. And the final item on this list is in contrast to last week's final item, which was addition by addition being overrated. So here this week, we are talking about addition by subtraction as something that is underrated. Because I already talked about this at length last week, I'll keep this very brief. But basically, my premise is that we have a tendency to look for things to add in order to get faster and perform better. Whether it's a new training intervention, a new piece of equipment, a new supplement, or something else. And this, in my opinion, is a bit overrated to look for things to add. But what is underrated is to look for things to remove to achieve a positive outcome. So it could be, do you need to remove some intensity to not be too fatigued all the time? Do you need to remove some source of life stress? Or do you need to remove some run volume to be more consistent and stay injury-free? There are many situations where removing something you're doing or reducing something you're doing might be the solution rather than adding something. And this, I think, is something that is very often underrated. And with that, that's a wrap for this week's episode. I hope that you enjoyed it. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and I will link to the episodes that I mentioned about shoe testing. So two of those episodes to check out. And I'll also link to an episode on heat preparation, an interview with Bent Rønnestad, if you're interested in learning more about that. Now, before we finish this episode, let me take a moment to promote our coaching services, which is what we do to make a living here at Scientific Triathlon. I would say that a coach is kind of like a problem solver that you have alongside you, and also somebody that will provide a fresh outside perspective on what you're doing. So in relation to this episode, a coach is somebody that can help you identify specifically for you things that you might have been underestimating and neglecting, and of course also the opposite, where you might be putting too much emphasis. So this is something that is really important for me to highlight, that real coaching is not just about getting a training plan to then go and tick off and check the boxes on doing some workouts. It's about solving a puzzle and identifying these kinds of things that we've been talking about today. Or that's just one example of how a coach can help with solving that puzzle, but it certainly is an important one. If you're interested in learning more or in being coached by us, then go and check out scientifictriathlon.com/coaching to learn more. You can read about all of our coaches, and you can email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com to learn more and set up a free discovery call. We are extremely dedicated to the craft of coaching, and we hope to help as many listeners as possible with whatever your goals may be and whatever your level may be. Big thanks, finally, to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.